here's a historical mystery for you. What happened to unrepentant Confederates after the American Civil War? Well, as you might guess, most of them just hung around, and some of them actually started causing problems shortly thereafter, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about another subset of former Confederates who decided that this outcome of the war was simply intolerable, and so they were going to look for greener pastures, places where they could continue to practice slavery. One of the places they went was, believe it or not, Brazil, and their descendants are still there today. They call themselves Confederados. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's all about the Confederados.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Have you ever heard of Confederados, Confederate expatriates who relocated to other countries after the American Civil War? Well, apparently there were quite a few of them, and they went a lot of different places. In fact, some scholars call it the Confederate diaspora. Recently, I was reading an article in the New York Times, and I came across this term for the very first time in the context of Brazil, where the descendants of those Confederados still live, and where, get this, they get together once a year, they dress up in Confederate uniforms, and they have themselves a celebration. Well, as soon as I read that article, I knew I had to talk about it on this show, and fortunately, the article mentioned two different professors who study this phenomenon. Their names are Maria Helena Machado. We'll speak to her in just a few minutes. First, we're going to speak to one of her former PhD students, who's now up at the City University of New York, on a fellowship furthering her research in this area. Her name is Luciana Brito.
I'm a historian. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Graduate Center at CUNY in New York by an Andrew Mellon Fellowship Foundation.
Right, the Mellon Fellowship, very prestigious. And I'm going to guess just from your lovely accent that you are from Brazil.
So, yeah, I'm Brazilian.
I think many of our listeners have never heard a Portuguese accent before. It's just lovely.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. So I'm Brazilian. I'm from the northwest of Brazil, a state called Bahia.
What is your primary area of interest? What do you study?
My primary area my work is a comparison between slavery and abolition in Brazil and the United States. So the book that I'm writing, which is the result of my dissertation, is study on the perspectives of several sectors of American society on slavery, abolition, and race relations in Brazil. So in my book, I analyze how Confederates, American travelers, scientists, and African-American abolitionists analyze it and appropriate it, the Brazilian example during the 19th century.
Very interesting. Well, let's start at the beginning. I think a lot of Americans, of course, realize that slavery existed in this country for several hundred years. What's less part of the American consciousness is that Brazil imported many, many more slaves than the United States did. So slavery was a much bigger deal in Brazil than it was in the United States.
Yes. Brazil was not like the United States after the 17th century with the process of emancipation and abolition in the North States. Slavery was an institution in the whole Brazilian country.
And whereas we had only a few hundred thousand slaves that came across the Atlantic Ocean, Brazil had millions, didn't it?
Brazil had almost 5 million.
Good heavens.
Africans, transported to Brazil. Brazil alone corresponded for over 40% of the slave trade. It was the biggest slave nation in the Americas and was the last nation to abolish slavery. Brazil abolished slavery in 1888.
Well, then that background is going to make what we're going to talk about today much more comprehensible. What we're going to talk about today is a term that I had only recently learned, Confederado. There was a group of people from the United States, from the Confederate States, actually, who went down to Brazil and took with them much of their Southern culture and much of their Southern practices. And I understand that you know a great deal about the Confederados.
Yes.
Please tell us about them.
Nowadays in Brazil, there are some cities, especially in the interior of São Paulo state, were in the past, they received a lot of Confederados immigrants.
And these are people who left the South after losing the Civil War, right?
After the Civil War, after 1865, they left the South of several parts of the South of the United States, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, North and South Carolina. They left the South of the United States after 1865 and moved to the interior of Brazil. So in this state, during this time, after the 1860s in Brazil, the Brazilian Empire was supporting a lot of European immigrants to move to Brazil, including the Confederados.
If I understood you correctly, then, a number of Confederates migrated to Brazil, and I believe they were invited or at least welcomed by the emperor at that time. Was that Dom Pedro II, I think?
Yeah, Dom Pedro II. You're right. So during the 1860s, the black population was a majority in most of the Brazilian states, and the empire and the Brazilian elites started to be concerned about the future of this nation, because they had a plan of Brazil looks this European or Europeanized nation. But although the face of the population was becoming more and more African, one of the Confederates said that the Brazilian cities looked like African cities during the 19th century.
Isn't that an interesting thing, is that the very people who were importing the slaves later became concerned about the fact that there were too many slaves?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And Brazil had a lot of slave revolts. So it was also an issue of public security, this amount of Africans and Afro-Brazilians during this time. So then Dom Pedro II started to support a program of immigration to Brazil. And he made connections with the Confederates after the Civil War, who wants to move to Brazil. Although they were not Europeans, they received all the benefits, like some tickets were paid, and they received support to buy land and to move to Brazil. The intent of the Brazilian Empire was to make the population become more, you know, lighter and more white-looking.
I see. So this was a very deliberate decision on the part of the Brazilian emperor to invite people, at least of European heritage,
exactly,
including white American slave owners, yes, to come down after the war. And how many accepted his invitation?
This exact number, we don't know exactly, but some historians, most of them Confederate descent, say like 20,000 people or 100 families. So let's say most of the families had like four people. So, you know, it's a number that vary. Mm-hmm. So let's say 20,000. I agree with almost 20,000 people. But most of them moved back to the United States by the end of the abolition in Brazil. But it's important to say that most of them were poor Southern Americans. A few of them were part of an American elite who were slave owners before the Civil War. So they had the plan to continue to be slave owners in Brazil for the rest of the 19th century. And some of them, the poorest ones, had the plans to become slave owners in Brazil or work in colonies, in farms that they were building in Brazil.
So slave owning was certainly part of the equation for some of them, because, of course, slavery was still legal down in Brazil. And if I recall correctly, some of your research shows that slaves could be procured more cheaply in Brazil.
Yes.
Than in
yes.
the United States.
Yeah. That is one of the Confederates. He was from South Carolina. During the time that I did this research in the United States, I had access to these letters. They are available in most of the universities and libraries, public libraries in the South, along the South of the United States. So his name was James Alexander Thomas. He was from South Carolina. He went to Brazil in 1866, and he writes a letter to his wife saying that it's amazing how, you know, slaves are cheaper in Brazil, cheaper than the United States, and that they have a lot of perspectives moving to Brazil. But although they were really excited about the possibility to continue to have slaves in Brazil, they believe in the stability of the empire as a slave nation, because most of them, they did a first trip to Brazil just to understand the society, and they didn't see the abolitionist movement, for example. The abolitionist movement in Brazil existed during the 1870s, so it was not like the United States. So a lot of these Confederates, you know, recorded that Brazil was peaceful, the empire was stable, the slavery was stable in Brazil. So these were the benefits of moving to Brazil.
Okay, and so a number of Confederates moved to Brazil, and if I understood you correctly, they remained there. But then the abolitionists became active a few years later in the 1870s, and you actually started having slave revolts and rebellions in the 70s and the 80s?
The slave revolts always happened in Brazil. Since the beginning of the 19th century, had the big slave revolts, especially in these places where some of the Confederates moved, like Rio de Janeiro. Most of them went to the interior of São Paulo.
And these rebellions have been going on a long time, but the Confederados didn't really notice that, you're saying, when they first made their decision to go. And it was only once they got there that it became apparent to them that there were going to be slave rebellions.
Yes, yes. The other thing that they, besides the slave rebellions that happened a lot in the interior of São Paulo during the 1870s, because in these areas that they moved, in São Paulo, state capital, the city of São Paulo, and the interior, had a strong abolitionist movement during the 1870s. Mm-hmm. So they were in these places. There is a record written by the son of one of the leaders of this immigrant movement. The leader, the father, was called James McFadden Gaston. He was from South Carolina. He was a doctor. Mm-hmm. He worked as a doctor in the Confederate Army. So his son, during the 1870s, he wrote his diary, "The Brazil is too complicated now to leave because there is a lot of slave revolts, and he can see that it's time to leave Brazil." And he, during the end of the 1870s and the 1880s, they leave São Paulo in 1883, I think. They are a family of doctors and missionaries. Part of the family moved to China to work as missionaries. And he says, since the end of the 70s, he says that he will be the son, will be committed to convince the family to leave Brazil because of the abolitionist movement and the revolts.
It's very interesting. You mentioned that not all the Confederados were slave owners. And of course, there were other motivations beyond slavery. Some of the Confederates were concerned that they would be tried for treason back home after the Civil War.
Exactly. Because in the letters, a lot of them, they sent the letters from Brazil to their families in the United States. And a lot of them kept the families, the wife and kids in the United States until they established in Brazil. And in a lot of these letters, they say, "Oh, I'm really concerned about you," when they write to the wives, for example. "I'm really concerned about you and how you are doing, surrounded by these people who, you know, until lately didn't know how it was to live in freedom," for example.
Right.
So they were concerned about the family. They were concerned about the racial codes in the south of the United States after the Civil War. They were terrified with the idea of African Americans carrying arms. They were terrified with a change in the racial codes in the south of the United States. They were afraid of African Americans don't pay subservience to them. So they were not only trying to move to Brazil to be slave owners, but they believed that as a slave society, Brazil had the same codes of racial subservience that operate in the south of the United States.
So these Confederados are fleeing the changes that are being wrought during a period, of course, that we all know is Reconstruction. Yeah. And these Confederados are concerned about their wives and children that they've left behind in the American South. Yeah. They think that Brazil is more stable and more familiar and more congenial to them because it still has slaves. In fact, a great number of slaves. But then they get there and only belatedly realize that maybe Brazil was not the slavery haven they thought it was.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the main reasons for this disappointment with Brazil was the racial mixing.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with a lady named Luciana Brito. She's a professor currently visiting at the City University of New York who studies, get this now, Confederados, American Confederates who relocated to Brazil and whose descendants still live there. After the break, we'll come back and we'll speak some more to Luciana, and then we'll hear from another professor. Her name is Maria Helena Machado. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with Luciana Brito all about a strange phenomenon I've just learned about, Confederados, American Confederates who left the United States after the conclusion of the Civil War and looked for greener pastures where they could continue to have slaves in a place called Brazil.
I've always heard, and I don't know much about Brazil at all, and I thank you for helping me to address my ignorance on this topic, but I've always heard that there was a lot more racial mixing in Brazil and in South America generally than there was in at least pre-Civil War United States.
I would be careful with this question because there was a lot of racial mixing in the United States too.
Oh, sure there was. Absolutely.
But the thing is that Brazil never had a law against miscegenation.
Right.
In the opposite, it was the opposite. The Brazilian society, although I know the United States had a one-drop rule operating as a racial category to define the racial place of individuals in the United States.
Right. If you had one drop of African blood, then supposedly that made you a slave.
Yeah.
Right.
In Brazil, in Latin America, was completely different. That's why Brazil, for example, created these campaigns for white Europeans or white Americans immigrants, because the plan of the Brazilian elites was to make the country white-looking through miscegenation. So when the Confederates arrived in Brazil, they saw slaves and free people with all shades of color, and they saw people who, for the Brazilian codes, were considered white, but for them, coming from the south of the United States, were considered mulattoes, according to the name that they called them. A lot of these people were occupying important places in the government, like the consulars of the Brazilian Empire. They were occupying high positions in the Brazilian army. They were doctors, they were lawyers. Some of them were Afro-Brazilians, but a lot of them were considered whites for Brazil. So there is one passage in James McFadden's book. He published a book called Hunting for a Home in Brazil.
Hunting for a Home in Brazil.
Yeah, it was a book published in 1867. Objective of this book is to be a propaganda for immigration to Brazil. But although in this book he tried to show all the positive sides in Brazil, he leaves some clues about the reason of some disappointment about Brazil, and especially the racial mixing. There is a passage in this book that he has a conversation with a priest. And he says, you know, I could tell that he was a mulatto, that he has African blood in his veins, but James McFadden was amazed by his intelligence. And he said, for one second, I almost changed my mind about the social place of these people. It's an interesting passage because he has an opportunity to question his values regarding race, but he stopped. He refused. And he's like, for one second, I was almost betrayed by his intelligence. Then I remember my place and his place in the society. So the racial mixing was the main reason of the disappointment of the Confederates. One of them that I already mentioned, James Alexander Thomas, he gave up of coming to Brazil. When he stops in Belém do Pará, is in the north of Brazil, is a region with a lot of indigenous population, and he is amazed by the racial mixing. He is writing this to in a letter for to his wife. He says that he changed his mind and he believed that Brazil would not be a good place to raise his kids. So then he gave up of coming to Brazil. So this was the first point of disappointment when they come to Brazil, is the racial mixing. Then the free Afro-Brazilian population, they had a citizenship, they were citizens, then they didn't know the Confederates until they arrived in Brazil. And later on, after the abolitionist movement become a big thing in Brazil, the slave revolts and the abolitionist movement. So during the 1880s, most of these families moving back to United States.
But a few of them remained.
Yes.
That's actually what brought you to my attention. I was reading the New York Times recently, and there's an article about the Confederados, because apparently there are many Confederado descendants still in Brazil, and they get together at least occasionally, and they celebrate their Confederate heritage.
Yes, yes. And these celebrations for the South pride in Brazil are south of the United States, are really local. Mm-hmm. They are in the not in the whole country. They are in the interior of São Paulo. They are concentrated in towns like Santa Bárbara do Oeste, the one that they mentioned in the New York Times article. There is another town called Americana. Americana was a colony, was founded by Confederates. So they celebrate the Confederate pride once a year in these towns. But the interesting thing is that they say is that they prisons in Brazil have nothing to do with slavery, and they welcome all, you know, types of people, include the African Americans and Afro-Brazilians, to the parties, to the Confederate parties. There was an episode that happened some years ago in one of these parties, that there was a group of tourists, and among these tourists, there was a group of African Americans. So when they questioned the Confederate community about the flag and the Confederate symbols in the town, they were like, oh, we have nothing to do with slavery. We came to Brazil to continue to be free. Most of the bibliography about the Confederates in Brazil are written by Confederate descent. So a lot of them say that, you know, the prisons in Brazil have nothing to do with slavery, which is not true. Because when you look at the letters, when you read the letters that they wrote to the families, the diaries and the notes that they have during the time that they are in Brazil, you can see they talk about clearly, openly, about how successful they could be as slave owners in Brazil, the prices of slaves of all ages, adults, if they bought families together. The other fact is that when these Confederate families came to Brazil, some of them brought slaves to Brazil. But we don't know these people, this descent of these slaves today among this Confederate community. They still exist in Brazil. This is a little bit out of your question, but I think that is interesting and important to mention. This is a part of my research that is a challenge because I don't know any information about it, about who are these people that arrived in Brazil with the Confederates.
Right, because it was illegal to import slaves at that point, but somehow these Confederates managed to bring a few Africans with them.
Yes, this is the question. I don't know if they were African Americans that for some reason were convinced by these families to go to Brazil. Or when they left the south of the United States, they stopped in Cuba or the Caribbean nations and bought slaves.
Yeah, that could have happened too.
Yeah, that could have happened too. I don't know. I still don't know.
Well, Luciana, we wish you the very best of luck with your research. And thank you for enlightening us on this remarkable period in American-Brazilian history.
Wasn't that a fascinating discussion with Luciana Brito? Thanks, Luciana. That was really enlightening. But Luciana's not the only one studying confederados, those American Confederates who left after the Civil War and went to Brazil. Luciana actually worked previously with another woman. Her name is Maria Helena Machado, and she's been studying the issue of slavery in Brazil and throughout the Americas for many years.
Well, my name is Maria Helena Machado. I am a full professor from University of São Paulo. I am a historian, and I am studying slavery and abolition in Brazil for the last decades. So my special interest was in the slave movements, revolts, crimes, and all kinds of political movement that bring enslaved people to the political scene in Brazil.
You know, Professor, this is something that I think is going to strike many American listeners as something they didn't even really think about before. We tend to think of slavery, especially in the 19th century, as an American institution, North American, U.S. institution. Mm-hmm. And yet, my understanding is it was a much bigger problem in many parts of Central and South America. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, because especially in Brazil, the slavery was an institution that contaminated the whole country and the whole levels of society. In the beginning of 19th century, even poor people, like widows, like a public employee, they used to buy a slave, maybe just one, by credit, to have an income, to complement the income. So in Brazil, it was very common. Slaves are common in the urban scene, in the country. And in 19th century, coffee plantations started developing in the southern region of Brazil, southeastern region, São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, and Minas Gerais provinces, and became the most important export of Brazil.
Now that's starting to sound a little bit familiar. You use the word plantation, but of course the major export crop in Brazil is not cotton, it's not rice, but it's coffee, right?
Exactly. Until the middle 18th century was sugarcane. Mm-hmm. Then we have a very important economy of gold exploring. And then in the beginning of 19th century, economy started to shift to coffee. Mm-hmm. And then became, between 1840s and 50s, the most important crop of Brazil. And the biggest consumers were people from the U.S.
Ah, so there's our connection. So we're buying
the product. Oh, yeah. All the time. You know that during the 1840s, people from South U.S. tried to buy pieces of Amazon province to settle a cotton plantation there with their slaves. They were planning to bring over their slaves from some parts of U.S. South. And
I did not know that. So during the 1840s, you had American planters in the American,
yes,
U.S. planters in the South, the American South, who
exactly
were going to buy up property down in the Amazon basin and
exactly. Isn't that incredible? And during the 1860s, during the Civil War, the person who represents the U.S. in Brazil, James Watson Webb, he presented before the emperor, Dom Pedro II, Peter II, because Brazil was an emperor at this time, a project to buy land in Amazon again and bring free people from the U.S. to Amazon.
Wow.
They are trying, because many people in the U.S. were trying to get rid of African-American persons, people. They thought that tropical countries were the paradise to African-Americans because God had created them to inhabit these places. So they thought that Amazon, because of the kind of weather and because it is part of a complex that they call Mississippi and Caribbean navigation, they thought that they should occupy Amazon as they try to occupy, for example, Cuba and Nicaragua in the 30s and 20s and later on, you know?
I see.
This was part, was just a plan, but it was strong at some point.
Well, we're developing all sorts of connections here.
Oh, yeah. And you know that during the 86th, Louis Agassiz, the powerful professor from Harvard, who found the Museum of Comparative Zoology, he came to Brazil in a scientific travel to collect fish. And he was the liaison, the connection between the propaganda of Brazil as a paradise for African Americans, to planters, to Confederates, and the Emperor of Brazil. So he did this kind of connection, a political connection, because he was a scientist, but he was very racialist. And he was very connected with Brazil.
Certainly one motivation of American Southerners to move to Brazil was that they perhaps thought the institution of slavery was safer there, that they could keep their slaves. But you've also mentioned two things I hadn't really thought much about in this context. One of them is that perhaps the slave owners in the United States thought that their slaves would be happier in Brazil because the climate was more similar to what they'd left in Africa.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thought, and I'm not
And they thought that tropical lands were prepared just to inferior race.
Ah, to inferior races, I see.
And that was part, the geographic theory was part of more broader explanation about inferiority of race and God's creation.
And exactly, yes. And that's the other thing you mentioned, is that a lot of this was in academia.
Exactly.
There were a number of people who were practicing what today we would call pseudoscience, who were coming up with all sorts of racial theories trying to explain why white people, so-called, were somehow superior to all other races. And they came up with all these wacky ideas.
Very, very strong, because they are polygenists. They don't believe that the whole humankind were created at the same time. And they have the same Bible or the same paradise. They thought that God had created different kinds of humankind. Some are full developed, the whites and the blacks and the reds, and others should inhabit determinate parts of the world and stay there, to not contaminate it to white blood.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with two women today, two professors who study a strange phenomenon, Confederados, American Confederates who left the United States after the Civil War and relocated to Brazil. Earlier, we heard from Luciana Brito. Now we're speaking with Maria Helena Machado. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Maria. Stick around.
From an autobiographical sketch Madison wrote around 1830, he tells us that at the age of about 12 years old, he was placed under the tuition of Donald Robertson from Scotland. He studied the Latin and Greek languages, was taught to read but not to speak French, and besides arithmetic and geography, made some progress in algebra and geometry. But when we look at Madison's surviving notebook from his early education, he's not filling it with esoteric philosophy or geopolitical analyses. Rather, the youthful Madison was more interested in copying selections of poetry and pithy generalizations about social expectations. In other words, it was popular literature. It excited and inspired a child's imagination. It spoke to his developing sense of humor. Madison was a child destined for great things, but a child nonetheless. The most important aspect of a young Madison's intellect was his curiosity, a curiosity that needed to be fed and cultivated, and Donald Robertson excelled. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia-Howell.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with Maria Helena Machado, a professor from Brazil who studies the phenomenon of American Confederates who left the United States after the Civil War and relocated to Brazil. Before the break, we were talking about different theories of race mixing, different levels of prohibition of mixing so-called races, and contrasting the approach in the United States to the approach in Brazil.
That idea that God created different races and put them in different parts of the world, and that they really shouldn't be moving between those parts of the world, that was actually cited in a United States court case as late as the 1960s.
Yes, and this kind of theory were very strong in the U.S. in the decades before Civil War.
Right.
So they are exported to Brazil, because in Brazil, the situation was very different, because as Portugal, our metropolis, were very small country, the politics of colonization was based in mixing, in miscegenation, you know?
Right.
So Brazil, and because in Brazil, the politics was to free people, not as a gift, but the slaves should save money and buy their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So we have freed black people, many mixed people. So for an American, North American, sometimes looks like there is no prejudice in Brazil. But in truth, that was not the truth. The situation is still the same. Because, I don't know, in Brazil, race and color doesn't even match all time. Mm-hmm. A person can be considered white even if you look at this person and you see traces of other descendants. That is a costume that is difficult to foreigners to understand.
Yeah, that is quite a contrast, because, of course, in our country, slavery, African slavery at least, went hand in hand with a great deal of racism and claims of white, so-called white superiority. You know, basically Northern Europeans are somehow better than everybody else. But what you're telling me is that in Brazil, there was much more mixing of the various groups of people from Portugal, from Africa, and even the indigenous peoples, right?
Yes, exactly. But the politics of the state, even the colonial state, was to populate the land with the mixing, because there are no enough white people to settle down. The Portuguese people did that in Brazil and in Africa. They mixed it in their colonies. They mixed it with Africans in order to be able to populate it, to increase the colonial settings.
Okay, and did I hear you say that that was because Portugal itself was a relatively small country? They simply didn't have enough Portuguese people to send
them? Yes.
It is a small country. And if you're a very small country, that means that you don't have quite as many people as a larger country.
Exactly.
And so if you want to grow your colonies and you want to make them powerful and make them defensible, You almost are forced into mixing more, aren't you?
Yes, that's the origin of the so-called racial democracy in Brazil. But in truth, it's not a democracy, because a person who is mixed can be included in the high rank of whites and be considered white. At the same time, the poor mixed persons were black. So it's very complicated. Social status and color has to be appreciated together. And it's completely different in the U.S., although, you know, even in the southern societies of U.S., there were a level of mixing that were not acknowledged by historiography.
Right.
You know?
Well, I
right?
mean, there was a great deal of mixing that went on, primarily because slave owners were raping their slaves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I mean,
at the same time that were this person still slaves, part of them just white, that become white, whitening, passing. That's the normal situation in all slave society, slavocratic societies.
All right. So you've got an enormous number of slaves. In fact, how many slaves were brought to Brazil?
Well, or millions. Brazil were the biggest slavocratic country in the New World,
wow.
Of course. And in southern part, in São Paulo, for example, the São Paulo province, even in the end of abolition in 1886, still have 168,000 slaves.
Remarkable.
So between 1831 and 1850, where the international traffic was banned, 3 million slaves entering Brazil.
Wow, that is a remarkably large, much more than what were brought into the United
States. Yes, yes, yes. But at the same time in Brazil, the levels of increase of slave population was very low. In contrast, in the U.S., the slave population were growing all time. So between at a little before Civil War, U.S. may have a biggest slave population than Brazil.
Because the Brazilian slaves, even though you brought over a lot more of them, were gradually gaining their freedom.
Exactly. And then they die more. It's a very complicated discussion for specialists because looks like that in Brazil, the babies, you know, die more than in the U.S.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. So there was a really high infant mortality rate. And so
exactly. Looks like that was the problem.
Oh, my. And so you brought over millions, literally millions of enslaved African-Americans or Africans. And then they simply weren't able to reproduce and thrive in the conditions in Brazil.
Exactly.
And, of course, as you pointed out, there also was a gradual emancipation that might be available and more mixing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But eventually, the institution, as it persisted, did become the subject of an abolitionist movement. So could you tell us about that?
Yes. In 1850, Brazil banned the international slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1870, there an important law was promulgated that freed the womb. All persons born after the law were free, but was under the tutelage of the owner of their mothers until 21. And in 1865, slaves with more than 60 years old were freed. So emancipation in Brazil were, you know, made in stages. At the same time, abolition movement from the city started to contaminate the slaves, the organization of the slaves in the region, the country region, mm-hmm. in the towns surrounded by this coffee plantation. And the group of slaves start to be unmanageable.
Right, unmanageable, right.
Yeah. And then they start to invade cities. And this situation, along with the political process of gradual abolition, created like a pression in the Gulf region that made this part of Brazil very violent.
And this
very violent.
And that's the very region in which some American Confederates called the Confederados had settled. So did they get involved or were they impacted by
yes.
the slave revolts?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. For example, because abolition was from May of 1888. In February of this year, a group of 200 people, farmers and their employees, along with, or better saying, leaded by two Confederates, which were at this time already Brazilians.
You've got two American Confederates who've moved down to Brazil. It's in the 1880s, and this is all coming to a head.
Yes, 1880s. Mm-hmm. And they were farmers and coffee planters. And because one of the sheriff of a small town nearby the place where they live, the Confederates, the farmers,
right.
They put together a band of 200 people, invaded the city, and lynched the sheriff. They went to their house, to his house, and he was killed in front of his wife and daughter.
Oh, dear. So the revolting slaves went to and lynched the sheriff?
No, the Confederates, sorry. Let me explain. The Confederates, they are very unpleased by the activities of this police chief because they blame him to be a abolitionist.
So the American Confederates who had relocated to Brazil don't think that the local sheriff is doing enough to put down the slave revolt. So they travel to his town and they lynch him.
Yes.
Oh, my. And that is reminiscent of exactly what was going on in the United States at the time.
Exactly. And that was the only episode of lynching in Brazil. He was leaded by Confederates.
That's not a pleasant story.
No, not at all. And next day, the ex-Confederates and their friends who participated in the lynch went to the police station and declared that they did that. They actually did, because this police chief should be punished by his what he was doing in the favor of slaves.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Right?
Well.
So it's complicated. What's complicated?
What happens next after you've had this slave rebellion, after you've had the Confederados lynching the local sheriff? How does the rest of it play out?
Well, finally, abolition was made by the declaration from the state. And so a whole historiography created the illusion that the law was a gift from the powerful persons to the slaves, that Brazil is a very peaceful and no racialist country, that because we never had segregation laws, everything was settled down and we became a racial democracy. But, in the last 20 years, historiography was very critical of all these interpretations, went to the source, the historical sources and recreated, rewrite all this history. And today we have, I think we have a black movement and affirmative action movement in Brazil, which is very strong. What took us a very long time because of this illusion that we made abolition with, you know, a peaceful declaration of the state and etc.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, Brazil managed to obtain abolition of slavery. That's a good achievement. That's a good thing. But then that good achievement was used to paper over and obscure the remaining problems with racial hierarchy and racial privilege. And so in some strange sense, the achievement of abolition was used to prevent further improvement in racial politics for the next 100 years or so.
Yes, and because the interpretation that Brazil achieved abolition without civil war was kind of mistrusting the history, because all the slavery votes, slave movements, abolitionist movement were just erased from this interpretation, you know?
So they weren't telling the story about this lynching, or they weren't telling the story of the slave revolt.
No. This disappeared from history. I was the one who found this in the political historical sources, and I wrote about that. Nobody remembered that. You know that the small city where this episode occurred changed its name. From never remember this episode, for example.
They changed the name of the town so that people wouldn't remember it?
Yes.
My. Well, congratulations on discovering this obscured episode. But on the other hand, I'm curious, when you started writing your book about this and bringing these facts back to light, how was your book received?
Well, you know, there were, you know, in the last decades, a whole movement to reinterpret it. This racial situation, the slavery, and the post-abolition in Brazil. That was, you know, a claim from the whole society, because we are, as Brazilian, a little, you know, tired of the interpretation that everything was very peaceful, and then, you know, the whole pink story about the end of slavery in Brazil. So I think it was a whole movement, a generation of renewing our history, you know?
Well, congratulations on that, Professor Machado, because that I think every country has a tendency to want to remember its own history, only the good parts.
Exactly.
And wants to maybe forget some of the less good parts, and every country has some bad parts, and so I applaud you for bringing those bad parts back to the fore. Absolutely. And I thank you very much for sharing this information with us today.
Thank you. It was very pleasant. And I hope my English doesn't make my interview very difficult to understand.
Your English is much better than my Portuguese.
Oh, yeah.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Luciana Brito and to Maria Helena Machado, both of whom told us the fascinating tale of the Confederados. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, which often extends far beyond our shores.